Session number 8255.
Mr. Broom, reel 2.
We chartered this sampan with its crew of skipper and one other man. They took us across the strait to a place called Sepang on the Selangor border, where we are eventually able to land, and went into the very small village they had on the shore there, and within an incredibly short space of time, we were in contact with the communist organization operating in that area, and we had quite a conference through the night in a little cottage near the shore. And we were very pleased to discover that they had started their operations against the Japs and had had a few successes, which was a very good effort in the short time that they had. Well, while we were having this conference, another chap came in and he said, Singapore has fallen and there's a total ban on all shipping in the Straits. If you've got to get back, you better go now. Well, we had a very quick discussion about this and decided, yes, we'd better get back because there was no point in staying there and being cut off in Malaya. So we got back to our sampan and set sail and came back to the Sumatra coast.
Before we go on with the next bit, if I could ask you about the successes which they reported to you that they'd had against the Japanese.
Well, of course, we took them all with a grain of salt, and I can't really remember much about them, but they said that they'd had an engagement with the Japanese and killed some, and that is all I can tell you at the moment. I can't remember anything else about it.
Was this just a local communist group?
It was a local communist group. They weren't the chaps that we had put in, but they knew all about us and so on.
And how many did they number, approximately?
The ones we were talking to were only 4 or 5. I don't suppose there were many others in the immediate neighbourhood.
Could we continue with the narrative now,
yes,
then?
Yes. We got back to the Sumatra coast and met up again with Colonel Warren, who had by this time moved away from the Bagan Siapiapi and gone to a port further north, called Labuan Bilik. And the other half of our operation, which was going to rescue the British troops, they didn't report again, and we heard later that they had in fact been captured by the Japs, so that was off. So then it was a matter of what to do next, and Colonel Warren decided that we had better get over to the west coast of Sumatra, ready to evacuate if necessary. And this is what we did. We sold the vessel that we had taken from Singapore. We sold her to the Dutch, who wanted her to take her upriver and sink her as a block ship against the Japs. And in return for that, the Dutch looked after us very well, and they gave us transport to take us over to the west coast. There was a lot of toing and froing, but we eventually got over to the west coast to a port called Padang. Now there, we stayed in some luxury in a hotel, but we there met up again with the British, this was the port from which British troops who had escaped from Malaya were being evacuated to Ceylon and places. And there were a lot of these troops coming through. And Colonel Warren suddenly found himself a senior British officer in this port, and therefore in charge of all the British troops coming through and so on. So his responsibilities were very greatly extended. Now he decided to buy a sailing boat, known as a prow in those areas, and arrange for our escape when the time came by this method. But he also said that this boat was capable of taking anything up to 20 people on board, and therefore he would, when the time came, choose such British officers as were in the port, and choose from among them the ones that he considered would be the best for the war effort in the future, and that we should all escape together. Well, we got this Malay craft, and again, that had a crew, a man and a skipper and two men. And we took it away from the main port of Padang so that we could get it away if the Japs should come without being held up in the port. We took it out to the coast some miles down the coast. And I knew something about sailing, so I was sent to stay on board. And Davis was left on shore to make the final arrangements for getting these officers off. And when the time came, when the Japanese had already invaded Sumatra and things looked pretty desperate, Davis appeared with these picked officers who were to go with us. And he brought with him a written order from Warren to me to take charge of the sailing of the prow and take her to Ceylon. Now, on this, among these officers, I have a whole list of them in the log, but I should mention one or two because their names come out a bit later. There was Ivan Lyon, who later became trained with sabotage from submarines and so on, and made two magnificent operations into Singapore Harbour, sinking shipping there, and was finally captured by the Japs and killed. But he was, at the time we met him, a very good lone yachtsman. He used to go about the oceans sailing on his own. So he was a very good asset to our company. And we also had a merchant navy officer who had with him his sextant and his nautical tables, and that was an extraordinarily fortunate event. Otherwise, they weren't in the RAF, but they were from both the other services, and a very good selection of chaps. We also had a Malay policeman who was John Davis's police orderly and who had insisted on coming with him, and my Chinese houseboy that I'd had in Ipoh, who also insisted on coming with me the whole way, and I couldn't get rid of him, so he came over with us too. And there was also one Japanese who was an anglicized Japanese who was in the intelligence corps, and he had been picked for his usefulness to the war effort. Well, we were eventually ordered to go, and we set sail. Now, in going to Ceylon from the port of Padang, which is halfway up the Sumatra coast, you actually follow the coast of Sumatra because it leans over, facing so much to the west, that you follow the coast of Sumatra up through lots and lots of islands and so on until you clear it when you're much further north. And this is how we proceeded. We had decided in the first instance that we would Shanghai the unfortunate crew to Ceylon because of the navigation of the vessel. However, it was perfectly clear after a few hours at sea that this was totally unnecessary. We had perfect all the skills required to navigate the thing over. The Malay crew wouldn't have been any use to us anyway, And in fact, they rather panicked even before we left the Sumatra coast. So we were glad to find a place where we could safely put them ashore and where they would get a boat back to their own homes later. So there we were, just the escaping officers and so on, without any complication of a native crew. Now, in the passage over, our main trouble was that we were at the end of the northeast monsoon, which is the one which would have blown us nicely over. We were just at the end of that time, and you get a lot of calm weather at that time, and in the end, those calms are broken up by the onset of the southwest monsoon, which usually comes on with extremely heavy blows, and of course was not in the right direction for us anyway. So we were very anxious to get over as quickly as we could before striking the southwest monsoon. We had with us a fairly plentiful supply of water, because we had foreseen all these passengers we should have, and we had secured some ex-oil drums, which took 40 gallons each, and lashed them down on board and filled them up with water. So we were fairly well supplied with water, and also with food. We had taken a pretty fair quantity of food. The only mistake we made there was we took quite a lot of rice, because it's a staple diet out there and it's a reasonable thing to take. But of course rice does need a lot of water for cooking, so it was probably a mistake to take rice. But otherwise we were tolerably well provided with food and water. But the trouble was that we never knew how long this trip was going to take us. So we had to reckon for 40 or more days. So we had to ration our water accordingly. And it was incredibly hot on this vessel. The ration seemed to us extremely small. In terms of long escapes at sea, in fact, there was a dash sight more water than a lot of these other people had to put up with. We had, in fact, 1 pint per head per day in this ration, which was to cover any kind of cooking you could do, and so on, cover all necessities. But with the heat and the necessity of navigating a thing in the sun and so on, that pint did seem an extraordinarily small amount at the time. However, it would have kept us going undoubtedly for very, very much longer. And we were able to supplement occasionally with rainfall, but not very often.
Did you make any landfalls on the voyage?
Only in the islands off Sumatra. Otherwise, there's nothing else. You go straight across. Nor were there fish to be had or anything like that. The middle of the Indian Ocean appears to have no fish at all. So there was no way of supplementing the diet in that way. The voyage was mostly a matter of alternating between a nice breeze and a good progress, and then suddenly days of appalling calm, even once or twice, even contrary winds. However, the boat itself was extraordinarily good. It was awfully well constructed, because we never had to bail her right the way through, to my recollection. She must have been as sound as a bell, made of teak, of course. And she was ballasted with pebbles. So it consisted of one huge hold covered with a sort of penthouse roof, and a poop astern and a small forecastle, which would each hold about 4 or 5 chaps. But there always had to be people down below as well. It was very far from comfortable. Gorham's navigation was absolutely wonderful, because he gave us a position every day when he could see the sun. But, of course, we didn't have a chronometer. And before we started, I suggested to him that he should take an average of all the watches that happened to be on board. And he was very scornful on that. He said, oh no, he said, I've got a watch and I know the rate on it and I shall use my watch for my navigation, which he did, but he got the rate on it wrong anyway, because when we were well over halfway, we actually got a time signal. We had a little radio set on board this boat, but we didn't have any batteries for it, and we only could afford to spend about a minute hunting the wavelength to get something from Colombo or whatever. And we never succeeded until about three quarters over, when he eventually got a time signal, and he checked his calculations, and he found that his watch had totally misled him, with the result that he had to put us 100 miles further back than he'd accounted for, which wasn't the best day we had. But otherwise, his navigation, of course, was a wonderful thing to have. Now, what else happened? We had, while we were within aircraft range of Sumatra, we had Japanese reconnaissance aircraft over every day. And the drill was, when we heard these craft coming, that all the white people on board would go below, leaving Jamal, which is Davis's police orderly, and Achuan, my boy, on deck, looking like fishermen, you see. And we hoped that that would deceive any Japanese. Of course, the fact is that there couldn't have been fishermen in those places because there were no fish, but we hoped the Japanese wouldn't know that. Anyway, all went well until one day this machine came over and swooped down on us and started firing. And he fired about three bursts, all told. And by the grace of God, nobody was hit. One or two bullets actually came through the deck when they were stopped by the pebble ballast. But otherwise, we were all right. And that was the last Japanese aeroplane we saw on that half of the trip. We saw another one when we were approaching Ceylon. We had seen one day a couple of cargo ships on an easterly course, which was very surprising. We didn't know what on earth they could be. And fortunately, we didn't signal them or anything, and they just sailed by, and that was that. Because, in fact, they must have been Japanese ships. The Japanese Navy had just been having a sortie to bomb ports in Ceylon, and they had bombed Colombo and I think Trincomalee, and they'd been up to Madras. They'd made a nuisance of themselves. And we, as we discovered afterwards, sailed very close to the whole Japanese fleet that night. In fact, some of us were quite sure they had seen some of the Japanese fleet. But anyway, we were not discovered. Next day, an aeroplane came over, and we naturally assumed that this was a British plane because we were much nearer Ceylon than Sumatra. So we got up on board and shouted, started waving at them and so on, until somebody said, it's got the rising sun on the wings. And so we all dived below again. And he dived on us, but fortunately he didn't fire. I think that he was obviously from the Jap fleet, and I suppose on reconnaissance mission, and he just dived down to have a look at us, but he never fired. So that was all right, and they never came back. Now, those are the main incidents of the voyage that I can think of. Our morale was usually pretty high, but on the days when we had contrary winds or calms, of course, it was remarkably low. But generally speaking, morale was good on that voyage.
Was there any sickness?
We all had various sores and things, but there wasn't any too bad sickness at all. We were very lucky. And in the end, we got a landfall in Ceylon, and I had to congratulate the navigator because the landfall was dead on our bow. It was Adam's Peak, which is the big height in the middle of Ceylon, and it was dead on our bow. Well, then the great problem arose, what to do. We didn't have any charts of the Ceylon coast, and none of us knew the first thing about what the east coast of Ceylon was like. And those of us who had some experience of yachting or sailing knew that we had to be jolly careful, because if we just sailed straight on towards the Ceylon coast, having no charts, we might quite conceivably strike a rock and the whole enterprise would have been wasted. So we decided to turn left and make round the south coast of Ceylon, so that we could get a nearer port we knew of called Hamban Tota on the south coast of Ceylon, where we reckoned we could get ashore. This rather upset the morale. This was the only time we had any trouble over that, because the people who had no experience of sailing at all had naturally assumed that once we had seen Ceylon, we would just sail straight to Ceylon and get ashore. So there was considerable dissent at this decision, and it was made worse when next morning, when we woke up, we had no sight of the coast at all. We appeared right out in the open ocean again. This was because we were tacking against the southwest wind, which had arisen at that time. So then we had to think again, because we were making no progress around the south coast because of the change in the wind. So we finally decided that we would have to risk it, and we sailed straight towards the coast with the object of picking up such landmarks as we could and trying to find a river mouth or something we could get into. And it was while we were doing this that another cargo vessel was sighted coming in from the north, and this time it was British. It was a ship called the Anglo-Canadian, which had been in Madras Harbour and had been in the bombing of the harbour, and they'd come out from Madras in a bit of a hurry, and their morale was pretty low too because of this. And we decided that we would signal them and try to get picked up, because we still didn't know how we were going to get ashore safely in Ceylon. And we made every kind of signal we possibly could. And the Anglo-Canadian was extremely suspicious. But she eventually decided to look into the matter, and she came close. And when she saw, she knew we were all right. We heard afterwards that all the signaling we'd done had misled them, because one of the signals we put out was something about heave to or I'll fire or something. And they knew that it is a common device of submarines to put up masts and sails and pretend to be a sailing vessel at times. We must have looked a pretty odd sort of craft in those waters anyway. However, they came along and they picked us up, much to our relief. And then they sank our craft, whose name, by the way, was the Johannes, which I hadn't mentioned before. And they sank her by gunfire and continued their voyage, and which took us round to Bombay. And there we were landed in Bombay. And that was the end of this particular episode.
What happened to you in Bombay?
Well, I'll go on from there for that. We were able to report in the end. First of all, we were taken to the transit camp and given jolly good meals and so on, well looked after. But we were able to report to what had been the Ministry of Economic Warfare and they were in Calcutta. So we were able to report to them. In fact, Goodfellow had already arrived there. And they had formed part of a much larger organization, which was the whole of the Indian organization of SOE. The Malayan section just formed part of that. So we were in touch again with our superiors, and we were sent off, Davis and I were sent off on a bit of leave, and eventually joined Goodfellow in Calcutta, in an office which was supposed to plan anything we could do about restoring the Malayan connection and the guerrilla activity and so on. But the first thing we were involved in, we had nothing to do with that, because the Burma evacuation was going on, and we had to, if possible, arrange for the reception of these chaps who were struggling out of Burma. And also, at one stage, we were the only people that had a signal link in Burma. The clandestine warfare section had a signal link to Fort Hertz in North Burma. At one time, we were the only people who could pass signals across to them. So we were rather involved in that for a time. However, we got on with our planning. And the first thing which was clear was that we must have some Chinese recruits. It was quite impossible to expect that two white officers could land in Malaya and start organizing guerrilla activities and so on without a screen of Chinese. So the question was how to get hold of Chinese. There are Chinese in India, particularly in Calcutta, in large numbers, but they were mostly second or third generation Chinese, and they hadn't the remotest interest in Malaya or the war or anything. It was quite obvious that that was a total failure. And we were rather up against it until we discovered that a Chinese called Lim Bo Seng had arrived in India. Now, he was a Chinese of the Kuomintang persuasion, who are the enemies, were the enemies of the communists then. And he had been very active in organizing anti-Japanese work in Malaya during the campaign. He was a businessman. So he had been so active that when the Japs came down to Singapore, he was one of the first that had to be evacuated by the British, and it was arranged that he should be got out, and he was got out to India. Well, we got in touch with him, and he was tremendously enthusiastic straight away, because we were the only Malayan people in India at the time, and he immediately said he would throw in his lot with us completely. And as he was quite prominent in Kuomintang circles, that was most excellent news, because he said immediately, he said there would be no trouble getting Chinese, I will go up to Chungking and I'll come back with Chinese. And sure enough he did. He came back, well, he came back with a promise of almost unlimited supplies of Chinese, certainly 40 or 50 of them. These were Malayan Chinese who had left Malaya out of patriotism to go to China and do their bit against the Chinese invaders in China, you see. So there they were in Chungking, having some sort of training, I suppose. And they were immediately offered to us, and it was a most wonderful thing that they should have been available for us. And they willingly agreed. And furthermore, they agreed even at that stage that if it was necessary for them to work with Chinese communists, they would do so. And that was very important, because otherwise it would have been rather stupid if we'd arrived to find there were still daggers drawn with the communists. So that was that position.